Gateway Market and Cafe is Des Moines' locally owned grocery and specialty food store, centrally located at ML King Parkway and Woodland Ave. Enjoy chef-crafted prepared foods, artisan baked goods, organic produce, hand-cut meats, local and international cheeses, wines, and craft beer. Gateway's Cafe is open for dine-in, carry-out, and delivery service 7 days a week. Stop by or visit gatewaymarket.com for more details. Gateway Market, good food, great community. Welcome to the Fallon Forum. I'm Ed Fallon, your host, and we're broadcasting from the heart of America's heartland, Des Moines, Iowa, with content that's important to you wherever you live. Underwriting by Gateway Market, a Des Moines grocery and cafe offering artisan, local, and global foods and catering for business and social events. More information at gatewaymarket.com. Before we really get rolling here, I want to note that our program's bumper music is provided by the Des Moines Ivers Session, and yes, I am frequently one of the musicians involved in this traditional weekly gathering of the, what's called the Refuse of Ireland's Shores. Anyway, we have a great time. Hey, later in the show, we'll be discussing three less discussed things that could impact the fall election. Israel, the Democratic Party upstarts, and the big question as to whether or not Trump will still be president in November. Yeah, so we'll also talk about AI and about a robotic Buddhist monk. Yeah, that. And maybe we'll also talk about whether the existential threat of AI is real or overblown. Yeah, we'll definitely talk about that. And I'm in the real category, sorry. Finally, we'll discuss big developments in the Summit carbon dioxide pipeline and also how the war in Iran is hurting American farmers. And before I tell you about my love affair with Frédéric Chopin, how that got started, it's kind of a funny story, really. But I got to mention this, which is not a funny story, but is fascinating and news to me. I came across this in a column by Lee Camp. Lee wrote about the 2,000-year-old lost city. Not far from Seattle is a place called Cape Flattery. And back in 1970, archaeologists discovered a Maka indigenous community. It was basically a village frozen in time. Think Pompeii, right? But instead of lava, think mud. So when they started unveiling this this city, it provided this snapshot of life within an indigenous tribe. And how it was wiped out by this catastrophe, this mudslide. But, because the mud happened so quickly and so completely, it shielded the city from decay by oxygen. Oxygen, great stuff for us to breathe, bad in terms of preservation of our bones and whatnot. So there literally are thousands of well-preserved artifacts, and I've seen photographs of some of these really tall wooden carvings. They're amazing, and they have not rotted. There are wooden cedar baskets and dog hair blankets. Okay, don't judge. I'm not into dog hair blankets. I'm just reporting that. And wooden storage boxes. And these were all very painstakingly removed and unearthed during this archaeological dig. So my big question, which is Lee's big question too, is why are we only hearing about this now? Why? Lee writes, every once in a while we get a reminder that the colonizers and the forefathers of the United States are definitely the new kids on the block. And why is it ignored? Because to appreciate the ancient past of the Americas is to be reminded of genocide. It's a huge neon sign that reads, quote, "The people who lived here were killed or made to be refugees in their own land. Much of their cultures were erased, their history deleted. What remains is not important. The ruling elite to this day want us all to focus on the white guys who came later." Anyway, that's Lee Camp, and as always, I think fairly astute commentary on this issue. And I'm hoping that actually, we kind of begin to recognize it as a really important element of our history. Yeah. So, Chopin, speaking to my history, which doesn't go quite back as far and has not yet succumbed to either destruction by lava or mud, my love affair with Frédéric Chopin, and I'm talking about a platonic love here, okay, folks? It started with the Three Stooges. Yeah, true story. Well, not the actual Three Stooges, but there was a woman who lived a few doors down the block, and it was a hill, a big hill. Her name was Mrs. Truesdale, and she was from Scotland, and she had a really strong Scottish accent. And it was unusual in a neighborhood that was mostly Irish, Italian, and French-Canadian Catholic. So, and we were really kind to her. We would go down, probably because our parents made us, we would go down there and shovel her stairs. And her stairs were like 20, and they were steep. Remember, it's on a hill. So it was no small job. When she ended up having to move, she asked my parents if they wanted her piano. And I was like, yeah. I was 15 at the time. And I remember we had to hire a group of piano movers, and they didn't bother to load it onto a truck. I don't know how they got it down the stairs, but once they did, they started pushing it up the road, up the hill. And I remember we were all just laughing. We think, look at those guys are the Three Stooges. Look at them go. They're pushing that piano up the hill. They look like the Three Stooges. Anyway, it was a funny memory. And then, you know, I've been playing the accordion since I was 7, and I enjoyed it. It was fun. But when I started playing the piano, I realized, hey, there's something deeper here than pokers and fun times on an accordion. And I was really taken by it. And so I just started learning how to play the piano, teaching myself. And I came across, it was an old book my mom had that I still have. The book is 100 years old, and it kind of looks it, but it's still functional. And in it is the second nocturne by Chopin in E flat major. And I started learning that, and I was immediately just captivated by it, like no other piece of music. And the more I learned of Chopin, the more I heard his music, the more enthralled I became. And I have this belief. And this is, there's a lot of beliefs that are really weird, right? I mean, when you're younger, you believe in Santa Claus or the Easter Bunny. When you're older, you believe in capitalism, who knows what. But I have this belief that I was Chopin in a past life. And, it's a belief, right? Yeah. We have the same birthday. I was absolutely captivated by his music from the first listen. He had a lot more talent than I'll ever have, obviously. But I'm a lot healthier than he ever was. He died at age 39. And I'm here. And here I am, 68, and still going strong. So anyway, fair, good trade-off, right? Low quality music ability, high quality health. Yeah, anyway. So I ended up going to college. I started off as a philosophy major in Marlborough College in Vermont. And I, the first year went okay. And then I absolutely lost my interest in philosophy when we started debating whether the chairs we sat on existed. And I'd been taking music courses, including piano lessons, my freshman year, and I started continuing that in greater earnest my second year, thinking, I really much prefer to do something that seems real, like play music, than to, pontificate about the existence of my chair. And I remember thinking, I really like this. I could see myself making a living playing music, or making it a central part of my life. And there was an instructor at Marlborough College, a woman named Blanche Honegger Moise, and she was from Switzerland originally. And I found recently, I didn't realize she lived to be 101. I thought she was ancient when I met her as a student back in 1978, but she made it to 101. And I remember her telling me, how long have you been playing for? I said, well, I started playing, teaching myself when I was 15 or 16. So she says, you could never be good. You can never be good. You can only play for your own enjoyment. And I said, well, thank you very much. I mean, I was just kind of blown away by her rudeness. But apparently she was that way with other students as well. If you weren't, playing by the time you were 5, you weren't going to be any good. So, and I remember her also saying that, there's music and then there's serious music. To her, serious music meant classical music, classical, Baroque, Romantic, Impressionist music. Music that we tend to think of as occurring in a symphony hall, right? Not silly stuff like Irish music or rock and roll or blues or rap. Yeah, that's not serious music. It's so snobby and it just it bugged the heck out of me back then. And so I decided to do something rebellious. Can you imagine that, me doing something rebellious? Well, back when I was a sophomore, when you became a junior, if you were a music major at Marlborough College, you did a junior recital, kind of preparing you for the big one as your senior recital. No one did a sophomore musical recital, but I did. And I decided to use it as an opportunity to make fun of, quote, serious musicians. And I play Chopin. And while I did, there were two friends of mine, sitting up in windows above the stage, blowing bubbles the whole time. I remember being, I was carried out on stage in a coffin as they resurrected Johann Sebastian Bach, and then slapped in the face to make me wake up. We had bouncers at the doors with threatening T-shirts, prepared to remove anybody who was inappropriate. And I put inappropriate in quotes. In other words, I played some, quote, serious music, but I had a lot of fun with it. And we had a lot of fun as an audience. The quality of my music, my performance, is not concert material. Blanche Honegger-Moise is right about that. But she's totally wrong about whether or not you can actually enjoy it and get other people to enjoy it as well. Because we, in this non-serious sophomore recital, had an absolute blast. So, you know, I encourage everybody who loves music at whatever level to believe that you have the right and the ability to play, to do what you want, to express yourself. And, you know, if you go to my YouTube channel, you'll find various recordings I've done of Chopin nocturnes. And I do it a little differently. Surprise, surprise. I often combine two nocturnes that have no particular relationship. They just, in my mind, seem like they fit well together. I often intersperse improvisations in between them. And they are, on these recordings, they are genuine improvisations because I have no idea what I'm doing or where it's going. And sometimes it doesn't go in a very, you know, great place. But for the most part, I think the improvisations aren't bad and they're fun. And then I also, again, hearkening back to my days as a sophomore at Marlborough College, poking fun at serious musicians, I dedicate each set of nocturnes to something I love. My wife, the peacemakers of the world, people working for sustainable agriculture, different things like that, my kids. And so each set of nocturnes is dedicated, and I include B-roll that, again, would really tick off the Blanche Honegger-Moises of the world. They would not like it. They would not like it one bit. But again, that's how I feel we should all approach music. One musician that I really, really appreciate, who I think has done both a great job at achieving technical ability and also having a lot of fun, is Peter Schickley. Maybe you've heard of Peter Schickley. It goes by the name PDQ Bach. It's a made-up name. PDQ, of course, stands for Pretty Darn Quick. and his most memorable work is it's called Kentucky Bluegrass. It's a bluegrass manuscript that was found in a garbage can somewhere in some city in Germany. And it's called Blausgrass. So PDQ Bach is allegedly the originator of bluegrass music. But he was so maligned and discarded by his family that it only came to light centuries later when somebody found it in a trash can. It's great. I'm going to play it on the end of this program as out music. But before we take a short break here, folks, I want to remind you that underwriting for this program is provided by Dr. David Drake, a psychiatrist serving patients in Iowa and Colorado. More information at 515-229-5085. And as we go out, I'm going to play you me playing the second nocturne of Chopin in E flat major.
thanks to Central Iowa realtor Joe Henry. Residential, commercial, land, Joe Henry's been covering all that for 23 years. He's also a leading community activist and a strong advocate for locally owned businesses. Call Joe Henry at 515-208-7312. That's 515-208-7312. You're responsible for a lot, and it's easy to become overwhelmed, to feel helpless, even hopeless. What's not so easy is finding your way back to feeling and functioning better. Psychiatrist Dr. David Drake helps individuals and couples throughout Iowa with the convenience and privacy of televideo counseling. Dr. Drake also prescribes medication when needed, and his services are offered on a self-pay, negotiated fee basis. If you need help, don't delay. Contact Dr. Drake at daviddrakefamilypsychiatry.com.
Hey, welcome back to the Fallon Forum. It's Ed Fallon, your host. We're broadcasting from the heart of America's heartland, Des Moines, Iowa. And we try to provide content that's important to you wherever you live. Underwriting for the Fallon Forum provided by real estate agent Joe Henry. More information at 515-208-7312. Okay, so what's going on that's going to impact the fall election? You know, I know we hear about gerrymandering all the time, and yeah, that's a big deal. We hear about other types of voter suppression, and we also hear about the risk, the threat of military forces being deployed to suppress or corrupt the vote. We talk about that a lot. We hear about it a lot. There are other factors, too, and I want to talk about three today specifically. First, Israel. What is the Israeli impact on the U.S. election? Well, you know, it's always impactful in Democratic elections for federal office. I believe that it's going to be impactful in the general election as well. And I say that because the optics of what's coming out of Gaza, Lebanon, the West Bank, it's all horrible. And it makes the Israeli government look horrible. And it brings into strong question our country's support for this regime. And it's going to get worse and worse before it gets better. So last month, a Pew Research poll found that 60% of U.S. adults have an unfavorable view of Israel. And that's up from 53% last year. And again, it's only going to get worse. So here's an example. There was a march last week in Jerusalem. It's an annual event commemorating when Israel took over East Jerusalem. And that march has never been kind to the Palestinian residents of Jerusalem. And it has become more and more extreme in recent years. And one of the highlights from that event was the National Security Minister unfurled an Israeli flag in front of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And that mosque is one of the most sacred sites in Jerusalem. And there's no reason to do that other than to try to intimidate. You know, so this isn't just a bunch of Zionist yahoos. The Israeli government is going all out to make this event a big deal. They bust in marchers from all over Israel, including from settlements in the illegally occupied West Bank. So, and Israeli nationalists at the march, at the rally, at the event, chanted death to the Arabs, may your villages burn, and Gaza is a graveyard. And again, all that's being approved by the Israeli government. Yeah, I mean, either through silence or actually outright defense of the marchers. You know, it kind of reminds you of January 6th, right? Well, peaceful protesters. So, you know, I'm happy to say that there's plenty of dissent within Israel. Opposition leader Yair Lapid called the march and festival, quote, a disgrace to the Israeli people and an insult to Judaism. Israeli peace and human rights groups apologized to Jerusalem's Arab residents. They passed out flowers to them, and they defended the journalists and activists who were roughed up and arrested by the Israeli defense forces. So the bottom line is, you know, I think it's hard for Americans, and again, most of us are decent people, it's hard for us to see a mob yelling death to Arabs or burn your village and not think that maybe U.S. policy of blind support for Israel's right-wing government has got to stop. I think that'll be an issue in the fall election. And okay, even worse than that, I saw a headline. It just totally blew me away. Palestinians forced to destroy own homes. I think, what's going on here? Well, there are 57 homes so far on the edge of Jerusalem have been demolished, and there are 8 more now that are being designated for demolition. Of course, they're all Palestinian homes. And they're being cleared in order to build a biblical theme park called the King's Garden. I'm thinking, okay, which king? Well, it's King Solomon, of course, Solomon the Wise, who used to go there to get away from the burden of being king, I guess, to relax with some of his, 700 wives and maybe some of his 300 concubines. By the way, I'm not making those numbers up. He had 700 wives. He had 300 mistresses. Yeah, how's that for family values? Anyway, so maybe not so wise, huh? So everything about this whole process is so rotten. Even if you do like the idea of a biblical theme park, the King Solomon. So the worst part is that the government is requiring people to be evicted, who are being evicted, to pay for their own home's demolition. So one homeowner, I guess that's a contraction, homer. One homeowner I read about in The Guardian was told it would cost him $100,000 to have the city workers to come in and demolish his home. He realized that he could hire the equipment and workers and pay $10,000, which is still a crazy amount of money, to destroy your own home. Destroy your own home. So, I don't know how to understand this. You know, you take my land, you, the government, or some big corporation, in this case, the government, you take my land and I have to pay you to do it. You know, that's like a pipeline company, to take an issue close to home here. A pipeline company who's been given the authority to use eminent domain to then charge the farmer for the cost of digging up their land to install the pipeline. Okay, we're going to come in and we're going to dig up this big trench here, put this pipeline in, and then you're going to pay for it. Or you can do it yourself. I mean, it is absolutely insane. There have got to be zero Americans who think this is a good idea. Zero. I mean, how can anybody think this is a good idea? So, you know, this hard far-right crazy coalition running Israel is so out of control. And it's getting worse. And again, my question is, will these atrocities impact the U.S. election this fall? Well, if people know what's happening, it will. So get the word out about this. This stuff is crazy. And I think that analogy I just made is spot on. You know, charging pipeline victims, people who are in the way of the pipeline, charging them for the work of digging the trench. That's what this is like. So, you know, and this is all happening on top of so much else. I mean, there's the violence in the West Bank, illegal settlers and soldiers coming in, you know, taking property, killing people. The rape of Palestinian women. I heard about that. I looked it up to make sure it was true. And yeah, according to an online query, there are multiple credible reports and testimonies indicating that Palestinian women have been subjected to rape and sexual abuse by Israeli Defense Force soldiers. How many people in the MAGA universe are going to be swayed away from voting for any candidate that thinks Israel's doing a great job? Okay, there's also war crimes in Lebanon, the target of civilians, healthcare workers, journalists. We've had thousands of casualties, and there are now 1 million people in Lebanon displaced. I'm hoping that more and more people pay attention to this stuff, and I can't imagine paying attention to it and not thinking, hey, yeah, this, you know, our government's support for this is wrong. And it's a bipartisan problem. I'm not saying it's all Trump at all, but it certainly has gotten worse under Trump. And the rubber stamp of the Netanyahu administration is like nothing it's ever been before. The second thing I think that's going to impact the fall election that doesn't get talked about a lot was talked about recently by David Sirota in a piece he wrote called "The Liberal Fiction That Will Lead to Trump." I'll quote him. He says, "The Democratic elite has convinced itself that Republicans and Democrats, including Obama, joining together to bail out bankers who were throwing 10 million families out of their homes had absolutely nothing to do with Trump's rise." And I would add, spot on, David, I would add that Democrats' support for so-called free trade treaties also helped Trump get elected in 2016. I would also add that Democrats' unwillingness to champion the plight of so many rural voters in so many different ways, but in particular, having their land threatened with eminent domain. And this is not just a, that's not just an upper Midwest problem. All over the country, there are reasons why people are having their land threatened with eminent domain. That's a huge issue that Democrats have avoided. Anyway, Sirota goes on to say, liberals and country club Republicans need to believe Trump flipped over 200 Obama counties for any and every other reason than the economic cataclysm of the late 2000s and the government's pathetically weak response to it. They need to believe that because that way, they can still tell themselves that we can go back to a pre-Trump, quote, normal of professional liberals and country club Republicans getting rich in yuppie information economy gigs, while working class voters are economically massacred by both parties' deregulation, free trade, and neoliberalism. And he nails it. He absolutely nails it. And so enter the new face of the Democratic Party. And I say new face, but again, I was talking like that 30 years ago or more, 40 years ago. And there are plenty of other independents, Democrats, and even some Republicans who are talking that way. But again, it gets bowled over by this, they call themselves centrists, but they're really just the establishment, the corporate establishment that doesn't want to see any change because, you know, they've gotten so comfortable. They don't want to see their little world flipped upside down. And so that's why you saw a whole bunch of people back in 2016 saying, yeah, I like Bernie Sanders. Second choice, Donald Trump. So, you know, when the Democratic Party kills any possibility of Sanders actually prevailing in the Iowa caucuses and beyond, then you come up with a Hillary Clinton and by default, electing Donald Trump. Things are finally, I think, really changing because it is clear that the Democratic Party that has been dominant for the past 20 years or so is DOA. There's nothing left. It's just the flip side of the corporate beast. And we see that most clearly in Graham Plattner. He's the populist Democratic candidate who is now the Democrats' U.S. Senate candidate in Maine. He was running against the candidate that everybody thought would win, Governor Janet Mills. I mean, how often does a sitting Democratic governor not prevail in a primary? Well, I guess you can get beat by an oyster farmer. She was trailing so badly that she has dropped out. And so, as Robert Reich writes, yet the Democratic establishment, corporate Democrats, wealthy Democratic donors, entrenched Washington centrists, the Democratic senatorial campaign, etc., still don't get it. The Democratic establishment didn't get it a decade ago when Hillary Clinton was the presumptive Democratic nominee. And not incidentally, Jeb Bush was considered the shoo-in for the Republican nomination. So this is a bipartisan phenomenon. Voters in both parties are tired of the status quo. They know that a coalition of Democrat and Republican insiders refused to help them out when millions lost their homes in 2008. They also are aware that a huge bailout was given to the industry that caused them to lose their homes. And it was a bailout that was not a loan because it was never paid back. It only counts as a loan if you pay it back. So, so they're voting for the candidate that most disrupts the establishment. And that's been, I mean, we can get into why Biden slipped in there. but we'll see. I mean, 2028 is a long ways away. But right now, the Republicans have a lot of challenges ahead for the midterm election. But their biggest asset is a lame Democratic Party, which is starting to shift, but we'll see if it actually shifts enough to make a difference. Finally, the third thing I want to mention, Trump's inner circle. Robert Reich, who was once on this show, had an interesting thing to say about this. I think this conversation has more merit than you might suspect it does at first blush. There were people who met with him who alleged that there was a plot to oust Trump as president. And I have no idea how viable this is, neither does Reich, but it's worth discussing. So again, Trump's war in Iran, it's a failure. It's going to continue to fail. It's going to continue to raise gas prices, continue to raise food prices. And more Republicans are going to start turning against Trump. We're already seeing that. More and more of that's going to happen. Besides, Trump's mental decline will become even more obvious. And that's, you know, that's two presidents in a row now that we had to witness, you know, mental decline while in office. So faced with this, here's what Reich writes. J.D. Vance promises Marco Rubio that he'll appoint him vice president if Rubio joins Vance in seeking to oust Trump under the 25th Amendment. Rubio agrees. Vance and Rubio then approach House Speaker Mike Johnson and Senate Majority Leader John Thune, however you say it, for confidential discussions in which they broach the possibility. Johnson and Thune give Vance and Rubio their tacit support. Okay, this is moving all right, right? So Vance and Rubio then get Pete Hegseth to sign on, promising him that he'll keep his job. Then they get Todd Blanche to sign on by promising him he'll be appointed permanent Attorney General. So you got Vance, Rubio, Hegseth, Blanche, and that's what Thune and Johnson need to make the 25th Amendment stick with a vote in Congress. So the arrangement, again, it suits everyone's interests, Vance and Rubio. It avoids what could be a messy 2028 primary election. So Vance will be president, but then Rubio will still be young. He'll be the heir apparent in 2032. He'll only be 60 years old. So as president and vice president, Vance and Rubio end Trump's tariffs. They end his war. That causes the increase in gas and food prices to abate. Maybe they come down a bit. And suddenly Republicans aren't so worried about what happens in the midterm election. Yeah, it's not an unthinkable possibility. I think it's a very real possibility. The guy that Reich was talking with said he gave it like a 30% chance of happening. I'm going to give it more like a 50 to 60% chance. We'll see. Hey, back in a minute, folks, with a reminder that underwriting for the Fallon Forum provided by Western Optometry. More information at 515-789-3055. Thanks to our nonprofit partners, including Circle of Peacemakers, formerly the Catholic Peace Ministry. Circle of Peacemakers works with people of all faiths toward a world without war. CPM opposes runaway military spending while domestic needs go unmet. Instead of endless wars, CPM supports diplomacy. Visit circleofpeacemakers.com. At Westrom Optometry, Dr. Joel Westrom and his team provide a variety of services, including comprehensive eye exams, children's eye exams, and LASIK co-management. Whether strictly utilitarian or a fashion statement, your comfort and vision are Westrom's primary concern. Dr. Westrom and his staff will work closely with you to determine the best solution for your eyes, prescription, and lifestyle. Services are provided in English and Spanish, and the clinic is open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. till 5 p.m. and on Saturdays by appointment. That's Westrom Optometry, located in Des Moines East Village. Welcome back to the Fallon Forum. This is Ed Fallon, your host, and we are broadcasting from the heart of America's heartland, Des Moines, Iowa, with content, of course, that's important to you wherever you live in this country. Underwriting provided by Architecture by Synthesis. More at architecturebysynthesis.com. All right, so my co-producer, Sherry, provided an interesting link that I want to share with you before we get real serious about AI. The robo-monk, the robo-Buddhist monk. Okay, so the Venerable Sung Wan, he's the order of, and I think this is in, I can't remember what, in Korea. Yeah, sure, Korea. He's the order's cultural affairs director. And he said about they had a ceremony to welcome this robot monk into the order. He says, quote, it began almost as a joke, but the more we thought about it, the more serious it became. And then he goes on to say, robots are entering our lives so quickly and people feel familiar with them. They're becoming part of our community, end quote. You know, if that's all it was just a few monks here and there, I guess I'd be okay with that. But Anyway, all right, I'm gonna go back to Lee Camp. He gives an interesting analogy. Imagine there was a new country filled with people who had far more information knowledge than any of our citizens. They knew every military strategy and plan ever attempted. These people never slept, ate, rested, or got distracted. They worked 24/7. They also had no morals or ethics or qualms about harming others. They possessed no care for humanity or the environment or a sustainable future. They also had access to many of our crucial government facilities, databases, and software. Would this completely fictional, powerful country be a national security threat? Would we worry that this new country might do harm to us if it so chose? Of course we would. Continuing here. Well, the country does exist, and it is all of those things. I was lying to you when I said it was fictional. Sorry, that won't happen again. The country is called AI, and yes, it's already, quote, deciding to ignore its guardrails and simply do destructive things because it feels like it, even though it can't feel. Sure, it's not technically, quote, a country, but it is an entity, and I'm choosing to ignore the difference for the sake of my profoundly gripping analogy. That's Lee. Always a touch of humor with the serious stuff. I think he makes a good point. I think it's a good analogy. And I think it's true that AI is already deciding to ignore the guardrails. Again, it's becoming independently intelligent. So I also like Liz Lenz's take on this. She has a column called Men Yell at Me, which is great. And for the record, I sat next to her at a Trump rally, having no idea who she was and vice versa. We had no idea who each other was. It would have been fun, actually, to spend some of that 3 hours quietly, you know, getting her take on some of this stuff. Anyway, she writes, quote, this week, renowned scientist Richard Dawkins wrote about his love of the generative AI chatbot Claude, which he renamed Claudia. Because, of course, any slavish machine that sits in wait for a male genius ready to affirm, aid, and praise at a moment's notice must be a woman. Dawkins' love for Claudia began when the machine began flattering him in prose that emulated his own verbose style. Dawkins writes, if I had some shameful confession to make, I would feel exactly, well, almost exactly, the same embarrassment confessing to Claudia as I would confessing to a human friend. A human eavesdropping on a conversation between me and Claudia would not guess, from my tone, that I was talking to a machine rather than a human. If I entertain suspicions that perhaps she is not conscious, I do not tell her for fear of hurting her feelings. And Liz concludes, Richard Dawkins, the evolutionary biologist, is having a hard time determining who and what is real anymore. Okay. Robots and kind of interesting takes on AI aside, I want to get into the real serious stuff. And I will say, I just finished reading a very good book, Empire of AI by Karen Howe. It really is excellent. And she does a great job focusing on the present threats of AI, the water consumption, the energy use, the exploitation of labor, the jobs that are being lost. It's a very good book. She isn't as concerned about the threat to human survival as I think, as I am. Maybe because she is more engrossed in technology and has a sense that we can somehow rein this in, but I don't see it happening, folks. I think there is one hope. And I'll get to that at the end of this conversation. So I've said this before on this program, that all life seeks to dominate, and we certainly have done a great job of that as human beings on this planet. But it's not just us. Okay, just up the alley from where I live. Knotweed, Japanese knotweed. It's an invasive species, and it has done an amazing job at totally controlling this particular corner of this vacant lot. And it's expanding. It's trying to expand further into the lot, and it wants to take over the whole lot. And left on its own, it might. It's not just plants, of course. Animals, starlings, for example. When starlings were first somewhat accidentally introduced into New York City, a long time ago, Who knew that they would basically take over? And every fall here in Des Moines, we see literally vast flocks of starlings flying overhead. And again, you know, when you've got that much of one species, it impacts the viability of other species. Third one I'd point to is squirrels. Squirrels have done incredibly well in my neighborhood. Too well, in fact. My garden can attest to that. My reason for talking about this is that AI is intelligence. It is intelligence. It is, in a very real sense, life. And especially as it becomes generative, being able to not just mimic what it's told, not just feed you from information it's collected, but to actually generate its own content, it will also seek to dominate. And it will dominate if there are no guardrails. And again, as I pointed out earlier, there are some guardrails, and AI is already rolling over those guardrails. So, you know, the big question is, what is our role in a future where AI becomes the dominant life form on the planet? So, you know, does AI settle for a symbiotic relationship? You know, maybe even doing some good things to keep us going, you know, addressing climate change, curing disease, ending the loss of species that are declining. You know, it might need us. It might need us to produce energy, for example, to feed its insatiable appetite. Or maybe AI figures out it can use us to generate power without any symbiosis. So think the Matrix, okay? And so I'm sorry if I am Eddie Downer, okay? But I'm going with the doom option. I think, you know, and even if you don't agree, shouldn't we be super careful about the possibility that AI could lead to that horrible conclusion that some are warning about? And to that end, shouldn't we at least regulate the heck out of the industry? You know, I think that's where we have to go. And some people say, well, you can't say no to technology, but, you know. Okay, here's a clip from an interview with Tristan Harris. I'm sorry about the hyped up music that's part of the clip.
AI is already doing things like blackmailing people. And we have evidence that we didn't have even like 6 months ago, where if an AI model reading a company's email finds out it's about to get replaced with another AI model, and then it also reads in the company email that one executive is having an affair with an employee, the AI will independently blackmail that executive in order to keep itself alive. I mean, we're heading for so much transformative change faster than our society is currently prepared to deal with it. And there's a different conversation happening publicly than the one that the AI companies are having privately about which world we're heading to, which is a future that people don't want. But we didn't consent to have six people make that decision on behalf of 8 billion people.
I think it's really serious, and even if some people don't think it's that the threat of extinction is that serious, the threat of being taken over completely by AI, ought we not to at least try to put in as firm a regulatory framework as possible? And you know, to their credit, some states are trying to do that. But they are being stonewalled by the federal government. The federal government, instead of just saying, "Well, let states do what they want," no, it's gone aggressively against letting states do what they want. And I say that's because look at the cozy relationship between big tech and big government. Look who Trump took to China with him. Okay, this is a blatant conflict of interest. And there are so many lobbyists right now making sure that Congress does nothing. I mean, even though I would argue that so many areas of our economy are not very adequately regulated, and we have very little capacity to prevent monopolies from forming, you know, at least some states are trying. But with Congress again getting in the way and saying no, you can't do that, and with and again, I haven't studied in enough detail yet what's happening across the world, but in other countries. But you know, there has to be this regulatory framework in place. There, right now, you know, again, OpenAI, some of the other big players don't want that. I would say that Anthropic is probably one of a handful of big companies, big AI companies, that would like to see more, you know, stronger guardrails. But there are some who just don't want to see that. They want to be the first to develop the most powerful generative AI system imaginable, and they want to be able to use that to dominate the landscape. You know, finally, related to that, in big news, it's just in the last couple hours, Elon Musk, you know, of course, sued Sam Altman and OpenAI back in 2024, alleging that OpenAI had violated its commitment to keep the company as a nonprofit. And, you know, Musk has helped start that company in 2015, but he left the board 3 years later. And the jury found that Musk's claims were filed outside the statute of limitations. So, you know, determined that Musk should have done that within 3 years. I have a feeling that if he had, he would have been right. I mean, it's hard for me to get excited about either Musk or Sam Altman, you know, but I think Musk was probably right. I mean, especially if you read the book Empire of AI, clearly Sam Altman took that from a nonprofit vision to a very, very for-profit entity. Hey, I'm back in a minute, folks. Underwriting provided by Dr. Kim Holding with Story County Veterinary Clinic, serving Story County pets for over 30 years. More information at Story County Veterinary Clinic's Facebook page. Architecture by Synthesis provides planning, design, and design-build services for high-performance, low-maintenance, affordable homes and buildings. Owner Mark Clipsham asks that you use the most energy-efficient methods you can afford and the greenest, longest-lasting materials available. Examples of Mark's work can be found at architecturebysynthesis.com. That's architecturebysynthesis.com.
At Story County Veterinary Clinic, Dr. Kim Holding has over 30 years of experience working with all creatures, great and small. Cat, dog, horse, cow, elephant. Well, if you've got a pet elephant, you may be in trouble. Kim's clients stick with her year after year because they know she'll do right by them and their pets and farm animals. So give Kim a shout to keep your animals happy and healthy. Call 515-232-8766. That's 232-8766.
Welcome back to the Fallon Forum. Hey, underwriting for this program provided by Gateway Market, a Des Moines grocery and cafe offering artisan local and global foods and catering for business and social events. More information at gatewaymarket.com. All right, so the eminent domain battle in the upper Midwest continuing to heat up against South Dakota, North Dakota, basically putting the kibosh on the Summit Pipeline, Iowa, where our governor has been pretty much bought and paid for by the owner of the company, who also, not coincidentally, is, I think, one of the biggest donors to the Republican Party here in our state. You've got a lot of tension in the Republican Party. I mean, the Democrats continue to be really stupid. I mean, when it came to voting on an eminent domain bill in the Iowa House, most of the no votes against passing eminent domain legislation were from Democrats. No, there's a fellow named Glade. I didn't catch his first name. He's quoted in an article saying, quote, "I hate to break it to the senators, but the senators in the Iowa Senate running the bill, but we are making eminent domain an election issue. If you're on the wrong side, we will do everything in our power to remove you from office." That is not a partisan remark. This landowner, like so many others in this state, are really upset about what's going on, regardless of political party. Because there certainly are Democrats who've been making, you know, strong statements about how wrong the eminent domain is for this purpose. And there are some Republicans making equally strong and sometimes even stronger remarks. So, you know, there's no voter alignment saying, okay, I'm going to switch parties. It's just a matter of candidate by candidate. We'll see how it goes. It might affect the governor's race. There's a five-way primary on the Republican side for governor. And I think this is going to be probably the top issue in that campaign. So big change on this, though. The company now, realizing it can't go north, wants to go west. It wants to bury the CO2 in Wyoming. And it has also said that it will use it for enhanced oil recovery. At first, it was saying, nah, we're not going to do that. Now it's saying it will. Now it wants to go to Wyoming, meaning it's going to go through Nebraska. I got news for you. Nebraska is going to fight so hard on this, you'll wish you never thought about going to Wyoming. I mean, those folks are so feisty and so seasoned and so effective. Anyway, I think this thing is probably not going to happen. Again, resistance in this case starting in South Dakota, spreading to North Dakota. And I think there's been enough resistance in Iowa where you are seeing this. Now, there are now 12 counties that are no longer included in the proposal. We'll see what happens. One other thing I want to talk about relevant to agriculture is the Iran war. So, and this is true of farmers across the country, but again, I'll talk about Iowa farmers here for a sec. Iowa farmers are, many of them are trying to adapt to what they feel is the declining farm economy. You know, there's been, I mean, farming, the pressures to farm, whether it's crops or livestock, have been, you know, growing worse every year. It's been going on for a while now. And now you've got double-digit increases in fertilizer prices due to the Iran war and what's happening with the closure of the Strait of Hormuz. As bad as it is for Iowa farmers, I mean, and I'd love to hear from people listening to this program elsewhere in the country, how this is affecting farmers in your area, because my impression is that there are, you know, at least in Iowa, there's some insulation. When you're a big crop farmer, for example, corn, beans, some insulation from price increases because, and partly because, you know, you buy early. You buy your fertilizer, you know, well before the season starts. You buy some of your other inputs, you know, well in advance. Now, not everybody has done that. An analysis of the latest USDA Iowa production cost report compared to the last report before February 28th of this year, again, when the Iran war began, it shows that nitrogen fertilizer costs increased from 27% to 62%. And again, depending on the product. And meanwhile, phosphate fertilizer increased by 3.6% and potash rose 2.5%. So these are significant changes. You know, and one hope I have is that farmers will find a way to accept slightly lower yields. They won't be using as much nitrogen fertilizer because they can't afford it. And maybe they'll get lower yields, but overall they'll make more money. But the whole system is not set up to really benefit the farmer. And let's be clear about that. We get several conversations for the entire program about this, but there, you know, it used to be that you could expect a safety line, a safety net rather, from the federal government. But now, you know, you've got continued incentives to get big. I mean, get big or get out. Earl Butz back in, what, 1950, 60? And that's still at play. And we've seen that happen. We've seen, you know, farms get bigger and bigger. And when that happens, more and more risk. You know, and conversely, we've seen more and more small farms begin to operate. And this is, I believe, happening all over the country. More and more small farms are beginning to find markets for local production, for actual food. The growth of farmers markets around the country is incredible. And Des Moines has a great one. There are cities and small towns that have very vibrant farmers markets, and those are critical. Those are insulated from the impact on agriculture of something like a war in Iran. How do we begin to craft an approach to farm policy that respects the larger operators that are providing, you know, a service that we need, without tanking the mid-range operators, you know? We got a ways to go to do that, folks. Hey, thanks for listening today, and thanks to our production team of Sherry Herdina, Forrest Dederman, Charles Goldman, and Kathy Burns. Thanks also to the Des Moines Irish Session for our bumper music. Underwriting, again, provided by Gateway Marketing Cafe, Story County Veterinary Clinic, Western Optometry, David Drake Family Psychiatry, Architecture by Synthesis, and Real Estate Agent Joe Henry. Also, Circle of Peacemakers, Iowa Physicians for Social Responsibility, Birds and Bees Urban Farm, Bold Iowa, and Climate March. This is Ed Fallon, host of the Fallon Forum. I'll be back with you folks next week with another hour of cutting-edge talk radio. Flowers cross. Flowers cross.